So welcome to part two of class three on writing the history of the First World War. Still looking at women now, it's a little embarrassing looking at the list of books because I know of 10 books about women in the First World War. And I know of 1,000 books about the First World War. So it's not very many. It really is not very many. We do have some diaries. And this diary, I think I maybe already mentioned to you, is about an upper class woman who stays in Britain during the war. Here, another book on munitions workers in the Great War. So this is obviously social history because it's a particular group of workers, but also it's a particular group of workers who worked in a very new way. What they had to do was, well, they built, they had huge ammunition factories, and what they had was big camps for the women to live in. So these are young unmarried women. Women didn't get married very young at the time. 28, 29 was typical for getting married because you needed to have enough money to move into another house, you see. So that took a little bit of time. And so the munitions workers were rather unusual because they were quite often a long way from their homes and discovering a new way of life. Another way of approaching social history is to look at organisations. Because our lives are actually structured very much by organisations, obviously by the family, which is a kind of organisation, except you don't choose the members of it. But also, you know, trade unions, sports clubs, hiking clubs. Sorry, can you stay with us, please? Thank you. All the organisations, now huge organisations like the trade unions, but also small organisations like sports clubs. That I noticed that among students, there are a large number of people who are members of sports clubs. How many people here are members of a sports club? Quite a few. My God, this is like people who do sport deliberately. I have difficulties understanding the concept, but yeah, I'm told it's very good. I'm sure it's very good. Okay. The church, even today, the church is a huge organisation. Of course, it's much smaller than it used to be, but it's still huge. In the First World War, the Church of England was a huge organisation. I think there were 1 million children in London who went to Sunday school. Massive. And it's very interesting because if you see what the church people say at the time, they say, it's terrible, the numbers are going down and down and down. But that's, they began with so high, you know. There was a point in the middle of the... Certainly in the first 20, 30 years of the 19th century, where everybody went to church. And it gradually declined, but nevertheless, there's a huge organisation. And this book by Alan Wilkinson, The Church of England and the First World War, this particular book was printed in 1930, so it's quite an old book, one of the first social history books. Quite an interesting... He's very negative about the church. He's very regretful. It's almost like an apology because the church was generally very enthusiastic about the war, which is kind of not what we expect really from Christian churches. The political parties. Political parties are big. Now they weren't always big. The political parties in their modern form were invented after 1870 in Britain, because before 1870 most people couldn't vote, so the party didn't need to have a local network to keep talking to people. And the political parties became very, very important after 1890. In particular, a lot of the social life in the towns would be organised by the political parties. Even in the 50s, if you went dancing in the 50s, you went to the... I wasn't alive yet, incidentally, just like to point this out. In the 50s, if you went dancing, you went dancing at the Conservative Club or at the Liberal Club. It was not necessary to be a Conservative to go dancing at the Conservative Club. My parents used to go to both. But these are important ones. So the Conservative Party in the First World War... Interesting idea. Of course, there was a certain amount of national unity, but also a certain amount of division, of course, both tactical and strategic division. Although all the major parties, the Conservative Party, the Liberal Party, and the Labour Party, were all in favour of the war, they still had very different ideas about it. And sadly, when I tried to look for the book on trade unions of the First World War, the first one I found was this one, which obviously is not the same at all because it's about America. As you can see by the spelling, that's an American book. Now, why have I put an American book on there? Because there isn't a British book about trade unions of the First World War, which is quite stunning. The trade unions became much bigger during the war. Much, much bigger. They rose very, very quickly. This was simply because, you know, you had the workers in the mines or in the factories or on the railways. And if they wanted a bit more money, they were in a good position. You know, the government really needed the things. So they actually got good wages, rose during the war, which was fortunate because, I mean, the level of wages was like, you know, you eat a little bit of meat on Sundays and potatoes every day. You know, it was a very, very poor. The people were very, very poor. And so, in fact, during the war, and this is what I may have already mentioned to this to you, bizarrely enough, if you were poor and you stayed in Britain and you didn't get killed, you lived better during the war than before. There was no unemployment. And at the time, if you were unemployed, you were hungry. So there was no unemployment, wages were rising. In fact, life was better during the war than before the war in some ways, which is one of these things which is a little difficult to put together in your head. Oh, there is one book which is about France and Britain, Labour at War. But when I looked in the British Library catalogue, this is the National Library with millions of books, and as you can see, I looked for the exact phrase First World War, plus the words trade unions, in all of them. And I got zero results. And the software says, did you mean First World Trenches? Have you made a mistake in asking for this? Yeah. So I found this rather depressing about how historians of the First World War have not been interested in trade unions now. Which brings me to another question. Why have historians of the First World War not been interested in trade unions? Well, I have an idea. People who study trade unions, historians who write about trade unions, les syndicats, huh, in general tend to be rather left-wing. And the favourite periods they like to study are the periods where the trade unions were strong and had good morale and were building international solidarity. If you are a left-wing person who believes in trade unions, the First World War is depressing. Because all the trade unions said, yeah, let's support the war. Yeah. So the First World War tends to attract, in general, more conservative historians because it is a period when national spirit was very high, nationalism was strong, patriotism was strong, and these are conservative values. So this is not an absolute division, but that is a tendency going on there. More social aspects of the Great War. We looked at women, we looked at organisations. What else can we have as social aspects of the Great War? The sexual history of the Great War, of the World War. This is a rather unusual book because it was first published, I think, in 1925 by a German, Magnus Hirschfeld. Magnus Hirschfeld was one of the first gay rights activists in 1898-1902. The history of gay rights is fascinating because most of the left supported gay rights in 1900, in 1910. In 1917 in Russia, there was equality for homosexual couples and heterosexual couples. But when Stalinism turned all that back, most of the left followed too. And so in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, the left didn't do very much for gay rights at all. And then it came back in the 70s. But that's another subject, but it's very interesting. So Magnus Hirschfeld on his sexuality. It's a slightly unusual book. It's quite difficult to understand because he had some rather unusual ideas about the British working class and enthusiasm for war. That's a very specific book then, a very specific book about the question of enthusiasm. How enthusiastic were the working class? This is one of the big debating subjects. Because, of course, it's very easy to find anecdotes. You can find lots of examples of working class people who were enthusiastic. But as we say in the business, the plural of anecdote is not data. Si vous collectionnez plusieurs anecdotes, c'est pas pour ça que vous avez des données. So, you know, I can find 10 people in Rouen who believed that the Americans never went to the moon. But if I write an article based on these 10 people, it's still a bad article, because you can find 10 people who believe anything. You know, there's a lot of funny beliefs around. Yeah. Interesting idea here about food. So food is not a social organization, it's not a social structure, but it is a social activity. Not just because we do it together, but because the way we do it depends on our society. For example, I know that probably most of you don't... L'habitude de manger du cheval, ça s'est beaucoup baissé. À mon avis, vous en avez pas mangé ce mois-ci. But if there was nothing else, it would be easier to get French people to eat horse than it would be to get English people to eat horse, who just really never do it. And so food is also social. This book was about the stomach for fighting, about what soldiers ate, but also what were their ideas about what they ate. Now, I just defined that as social history, but as you can see, the publisher didn't agree, because they've got cultural history of modern war. So we're going to come on to cultural history in a moment. And the division between social history and cultural history, nobody knows where it is. It's somewhere, but nobody knows exactly where it is. It's a big debate. Here was another one. Soldiers and the culture of caregiving. Yeah. Soigner. Le culture du soin. Okay, and again, that's counted as social. But these last two are quite a good transition, because I think they're kind of social, but they're not cultural. So, which brings us on to the third field. Okay, the third field, cultural history. Now, remember, I already told you that the old fields do not disappear when a new one arrives. Yeah. So military history begins in 1918 and continues. Social history rises in 1955 and rises, and then there's less of it, but it continues. And cultural history rises up in the 1980s. And it is when the number of universities is still rising. There are far more historians today than there were 30 years ago. Across the world, I'm not sure if that's the case in Britain, because Britain is rather special. As you know, it costs €11,000 a year to go to university. And so when I was young, and I said to my mother, "Oh, I think I'll go to university," she said, "Oh, it was free." So she said, "Oh, yeah, do what you want." You know, and obviously today, it's a working class family, so obviously today, if it was €11,000 a year, say, "Mom, I'm going to university." Tell me exactly what you're studying and why. Of course, because, you know, you can't. There are fewer people doing history in Britain today because it's history. You might get a job, you might not. Whereas, of course, everybody who does an English degree gets a wonderful job, so that's fine. Okay, yeah, I'm only joking. That was funny, wasn't it? No, not really. Okay. Right. So when we look at cultural history, we're going to start again with the question of definitions. And unfortunately, when we look in our dictionary, the Oxford Dictionary, you can rely on the Oxford Dictionary. They are the people who know. And when you look at the Oxford Dictionary, there's no exact match found for cultural history. We don't know what it is. Sorry. So that's rather depressing, isn't it? Yeah, no exact match found for cultural history in British and World English. Here are our nearest results from other dictionaries. Okay, thank you. No, thank you. So what is it? So I have to give you my opinion about what it is. Well, cultural history came out of social history in two ways. First of all, people wanted to ask wider questions. Historians were saying, yeah, social structures, but there are many, many things about how people live which are not social structures. So how about, you know, attitudes to friendship? If you wanted to write a history of friendship in the First World War, what does friendship mean to soldiers and to civilians? Because friendship does not mean the same at the time as it does today. It's very, very. In fact, even in today's cultural world, you find, for example, that French people don't have the same idea of what a friend is as English people do. It's just a different. It's a different game. Yeah. It's like French people don't have the same idea of what a joke is as English people do. In fact, French people don't know what a joke is. Okay, that wasn't funny either. You see what I mean? Okay, right. So that was the first thing is that people wanted to ask wider questions. They wanted to ask questions about fear, friendship, which are not social, but there's something which changes with society. Secondly, the influence of Marxism in the universities was going down. The Soviet Union collapsed in 1992, and although many Marxists did not defend particularly that particular form in the Soviet Union, nevertheless, there was a general feeling, not for everybody, but a lot of people, that, you know, yeah, Marxism is old-fashioned now. Let's stop doing that. And so cultural history, in some ways, was a compromise. Cultural history allowed everybody to continue studying ordinary people. Yeah, so it's moved away from great man history, just studying the kings and the prime ministers, military history, just studying the strategy. Social history is more about ordinary people, and cultural history is also mostly about ordinary people, but it moves away from Marxism. And so that's really what was happening in the 60s and 70s. One of the big influential books is this one, which is now 30 years old, I think, The Great War and Modern Memory by Paul Fossel. So I haven't got a completely satisfactory definition of cultural history, but I'm hoping that if I give you plenty of examples, you'll get a kind of idea. Yeah. The reason I haven't given you a clear definition is because nobody's got one. Yeah. And these days, everybody says, all historians almost in universities say, I'm doing cultural history. And then you say, what is it? And say, nice weather, isn't it? You know, they changed it because it's a very, very hard question. Now, Paul Fossel talked about how soldiers in their diaries and literary writers wrote about the First World War, what it meant to the culture, what was the effect on the culture. And so one important aspect of cultural history is the history of representations. That is, how was the First World War represented year after year? So that's something you can study today. You know, obviously, you are so incredibly young that you have never met anybody who fought in the First World War. That's really young. So the First World War means something completely different to your generation. What does it mean? You can study this. Okay, you can study this. And that's one of the things he did. And indeed, Nicolas Offenstadt, who is probably the best historian writing in French today, and I'm sure he wouldn't mind me saying that. I do recommend, I recommended his book on historiographie. And he wrote this book, 14-18 aujourd'hui. Aujourd'hui. There is a chapter on the First World War in rock songs and rap. There's a chapter on the First World War in bande dessinée. 21st century. So he looks at all the different, on the television and on the les associations du patrimoine de la Première Guerre. So he looks at everything which is happening today about the memory. So this is not the only way of doing cultural history. Not all of cultural history is about memory, but memory is an important chunk in there, a very important thing in there. Another aspect, so if you look at cultural history, you get a lot of history of representation, a lot of history of memory, but you also get a certain amount of culture during the war, cultural events and activity during the war, and of course this is my specialty with popular song, so that this book is about the arts, entertainment and propaganda, 1914 to 1918. I can't see the name of the author there. This is a brand new book just come out this year. In my opinion, it's not very good. About modern popular music. What's good about it is he looks at folk music, heavy metal, rap. He looks at hundreds of songs about the First World War in modern popular music from 1980 to 2015. and tries to see what do they do with it. Now, what's very, very interesting about it is that he talks about a lot of different kinds of music, and that's very interesting. But after that, he's rather in the current, which I don't like very much, of the revisionist school, that he tends to defend the British Empire and the First World War and the British generals and so on. That's a current which is not too much to my liking, but a great picture. Other things going on during the war, you get some very difficult ideas, because here you have the secret battle, emotional survival in the Great War. Here's a new question. How did the soldiers survive? It's so incredibly stressful. How did they do it? These are very difficult history books to write. How do you know? How are you going to find out, you know? Because the first thing which is absolutely typical about soldiers from the First World War is that typically they never told anybody their story. Typically they did not tell their families what their story was. I think I mentioned this last week actually, a number of reasons for this. First of all, men don't talk to women about things like this. Even today, but especially 100 years ago, yes, it was the duty of a man was not to tell your woman, your wife and your mother and your daughters in particular about the terrible, terrible violence and so on. Secondly, we're now beginning to think that psychological damage was much, much more common than has been thought. Jay Winter, one of the best historians of the First World War, recently wrote a new piece about shell shock, that is to say mental illness after the First World War, and he says we need to multiply by 10 our previous ideas. In fact, this book is a little disappointing because it's interesting, but it's based on a corpus, so that's good, it's based on a corpus of letters written by men to their mothers. It's all about letters written by men to their mothers. But it's very difficult to draw conclusions because, you know, how much of the truth did men tell their mothers? I don't know. Yeah? I never tell my mother anything, but then I'm not in a war. Experience, memory, and the First World War in Britain. I can't remember what that's about, actually. But these are all cultural history. A war imagined. Now, to go back briefly to the question of memory, that we also have within cultural studies the history of commemoration. Commemoration has changed a lot. This is Unionist and Great War commemoration in the north of Ireland from 1914 to 1939. This is to say that this is a book about how the First World War, how the memory of the First World War was used politically by the Unionists. The Unionists in the north of Ireland are those people and organisations who want Northern Ireland to stay part of Britain and absolutely not to unify with the South. And so they are very often more patriotic than the more patriotic British than the British are, because they're feeling themselves under threat. So for example, if you go to Belfast in Northern Ireland, you can see murals, paintings on the walls, our heroes from the First World War, big paintings on the sides of houses. Now that's very, very interesting, because if you have paintings on the side of houses, it's very different from a monument in the park. The paintings on the side of houses generally have much more community support. That's why there's no graffiti and so on. They have to clean them every few years. The people who live in the house have to agree. The people who live in the street have to agree. So it's an important symbol. So we have sometimes had histories of particular aspects of commemoration. War memory and popular culture. Sometimes this can get difficult to understand. Essays on modes of remembrance and commemoration. I have no idea what that title means. For me, remembrance means commémoration, and commemoration means commemoration. So, you know, I have no idea what they're talking about here. But obviously they think there's a difference, remembrance and commemoration. In English, we use remembrance only to talk about war. Remembrance Day is the 11th of November. Whereas commemoration can be, you know, you can commemorate anything. You know, oh, let's commemorate the last time that Britain won the World Cup. You know, it's much more general. So I don't know exactly what's going on there. But it produces a lot of books, does this. Again, the politics of war, memory and commemoration. And this is what I will be going on to next week with memory studies. This is an interesting one. There have been a lot of books written. I mean, five or six books written about battlefield tourism. If you go to the battlefields, which are not very far from here, really, the battlefields of the First World War, a lot of them are near Amiens, Picardy. And if you go there and you walk around the battlefields and you go to the museums, if you like Australians, you can meet all the Australians you like there. There's loads of them. You meet Australians, Scottish, English, Canadians, and from time to time, you meet a French person. Battlefield tourism is very, very big in Anglophone countries and not so hot in France. I mean, it does exist. But for example, I don't have a car, and if you want to do the battlefields, it's better to have a car because there's quite a lot of them. And so I was looking for a coach trip, an excursion bus, and there are lots of them. They all depart from London and none from Paris. Just to show that battlefield tourism is a big thing. And now this was so big it's so big today that at the beginning of the commemoration, the Prime Minister of the time in Britain said, "We want before 2018, we want every school child in Britain to visit the battlefields of the First World War in France." That's what he said. Now, they didn't do it. He regretted saying it because it's so expensive and big, you know. But he said, "Yo, this must happen," you know. And so, whereas you can't imagine a French Minister of Education saying, "Oh yeah, all children in France must visit the battlefields," you know. So Verdun, let's all go to Verdun on holiday. Yeah, no, there's more. There's a very different attitude in France than in Britain, of course. But this book is more specific because it's about battlefield tourism between 1919 and 1939, only the first 20 years. So that's a big difference. Now, of course, tourism, it sounds kind of fun today, but between 1919 and 1939, very, very often the people coming were coming to see the graves of their parents, of their fathers. Yeah. There was an important decision taken in 1914 in Britain. After a few weeks of the war, nobody was allowed to bring the bodies home. Yeah. There were a number of reasons for this. First of all, politically, 1,000 bodies arriving in London for every day was politically, you know, not good. Yeah. But secondly, also that the logistics would have been huge, and they were busy fighting a war. They didn't want to have to organise this. But thirdly, and perhaps most importantly, of course, if they just allowed people privately to do it, the rich could do it because it just costs money, you know, go and get the body, you know. And this would, again, politically, if the rich could bring their boys home and the poor could not, and the ordinary people could not, that would have been politically very, very difficult. And so they decided after a few weeks of war, because a few rich people did bring their sons back in the first few weeks, and then I went, "My God, there's a problem." And so, no repatriation of bodies. And at the end of the war, they made a special agreement with the French government that the French government gave to Britain places for cemeteries and promised never to take them back again. And they're still, there's actually an organisation, the Imperial Graves Commission or something, which still today runs these things. Another interesting thing about battlefields, they also decided every soldier, rich or poor, will have the same gravestone. You know the problem with, if you go to an ordinary cemetery in Rouen, you have rich people with a lovely thing, and poor people with this little thing, yeah? For the battlefields of the First World War, they all have identical gravestones. Doesn't matter if they were rich or poor. Not quite identical, there's a slight difference. Why would you not want to have an identical gravestone with everybody? Cross, yeah. Well, almost 90% of them have a cross. What's the problem with the cross? It is a bit Christian, isn't it? Yeah, yeah. And they had a special, different one for Jews and Muslims. Yeah, with a different shape. Yeah, c'est vrai que c'est un peu raide quand même d'imposer une croix à tout le monde, même s'ils ne sont pas de culture chrétienne. So that's what they did. That's what they did there. Yeah. So this one about battlefield tourism until 1939. So having said. Having given you some examples, I'm going to come back to the definition of cultural history, not because I'm going to suddenly find the solution, but here are some of the characteristics. So if we don't have a general definition, at least we have a list of some of the general characteristics. This is definitely one to photograph, this one. Okay. So I'm going to give you 2 minutes to note it down, because this is really quite concentrated, and yes, I don't often think about you, but I do occasionally. Yeah. Après, il faut faire le liaison Bluetooth pour pouvoir l'intégrer dans votre document. Pas encore, non, on n'est pas à ce niveau. Vous avez gagné. Ouais. Okay. So first of all, I have four aspects which characterize. They don't define cultural history. They characterize cultural history. Then I have two strong points and two criticisms. Okay, so that's going to help us. Like I said, we're not going to find a general definition. This is the best we have. So the first thing is, it's a very wide view of culture. This is a kind of history which allows you to find new questions. You know, about mental illness, about friendship. If you can find new sources, you can have new questions. It's all culture, and culture is enormous. In fact, somebody defined culture as the things we do because we are social beings. Well, that's like almost everything, yeah? Secondly, and this is important, is that cultural history writes about culture in a different way from previous historians. Before cultural history, you had history of art. Even today, you still have history of art. And now history of art, not always, but typically history of art looks at the relationship between different works of art. So you look at Caravaggio's works and say, who was he influenced by? What did he invent which would influence other painters? Yeah. And so it's really about the relationship between painters' work and other painters' work. Society is not really present. And so that's a typical history of art approach. And cultural history does not do that. Cultural history is a history of society. So even if you were writing a cultural history of Caravaggio, you would be looking at, look at the peasants that he represents. What did it mean to him, being a peasant? What kind of peasants did he have in his life? So it would be much more social. Secondly, history of ideas. This is a similar idea, that you still have history of ideas today. A lot of historians don't like history of ideas. The reason is because typically, not always, but typically, history of ideas is the relationship between different documents. Here is a book about democracy by Voltaire. And if I have a history of ideas approach, I say, oh yeah, who influenced Voltaire? Who did Voltaire influence? What is the relationship between this document and other documents, which are not famous at all, which were published a few years before? But it's about the relationship between documents and documents. And society is not the centre of it. So cultural history puts society at the centre, and in this way it is distanced from previous approaches. Thirdly, it tries to concentrate on what is measurable and its influence. One of the problems of writing about society in general is it's very difficult to prove. It's like, of course, when you go abroad, when you go to England, people say, what do French people think about this? I don't know. Because people like to imagine that French people are like this and German people are like this, and because you're French, you know, so you must be able to explain. As you know, this is really completely impossible. But we also do this with society. We say, oh yeah, people in the 1960s were like this. You can buy 100 books that say this. Yeah. But the problem is, if you're a historian, you want something which is measurable. Yeah. So you want to be able to say, you know, supposing you're writing the history of friendship, you want to be able to say, I have 500 letters that soldiers wrote to their mothers, and they talked 230 times about friends and only 3 times about beer. I'm making this up, but yeah, that's something that you can measure, because otherwise you very quickly get to speculation and anecdotes, and that's a big danger. And then finally, then, it is still, cultural history is still generally a history from below, a history of ordinary people where we're not specially interested in. You don't normally, you could write a cultural history of generals in the First World War, you could, it can be done, but that's not typical. What's typical of cultural history is the cultural history of groups of ordinary people. Now, the strong points of cultural history, first of all, the concentration on lived experience. That is, you know, what we're interested in is not just the objective facts, but how it felt subjectively to be a soldier. Again, you know, this can be difficult to understand because, you know, of course, when you join the war, you join the army and you go to war. I think it's like 20% die. So you have 1 chance in 5 of coming back dead. That sounds horrible. Except that if you look at the life expectancy 100 years ago, people were habituated to the idea of people dying around them. Yeah. So it was not exactly, I'm not saying it was okay, but it was not exactly the same as it is today. Today, you know, the meaning of children has changed because 100 years ago, you had 6 children and 4 of them survived. And that was just life. You were not sad because it's the same as everybody else. Whereas, of course, today when people lose children, it's much, much harder, of course, because that's a social meaning. Secondly, cultural history has succeeded in widening the historical object. The postcard, battlefield tourism, all sorts of things which we didn't know were history become history. History becomes bigger. Now, of course, historians like that because it means we have more jobs and more books to write. Now, the criticisms that has been subjected to, sometimes people say that cultural history can ignore important institutions like the state, and that cultural history can suggest a uniformity of culture which does not exist in a nation. Let me give you some examples. If you look at the attitude of Scottish people to the First World War, that would be a cultural history, because it's history of the attitudes. One of the problems is that the attitudes don't come from nowhere. They don't automatically spring up in people's heads. And so if you're just going to study attitudes with statistics and so on, you might miss all the organizations, the political parties, the trade unions, which have created and constructed these attitudes. So sometimes cultural history looks at the group as a lot of individuals. So in that way, it would be the opposite of social history. With social history, we say, you know, what are the big attitudes of the time and what is the material reality they come from? which is the Marxist approach. The Marxist approach is that the centre of history is the creating and recreating of everyday life. Yeah. So what the activities which need to happen to create the table and the cheeseburger and the clothes, this is the centre of social life from a Marxist point of view. That's where you have to start to explain things. Whereas cultural history sometimes can be accused of acting as if your culture is just appears in your head and isn't influenced by your material activity or the state or the trade union or the political party or the sports club or the church and so on. I know that's difficult to understand. That's the hardest thing I'm going to say in this seminar. But it does. You need. We'll keep coming back to it because otherwise we'll not go. So that, and here we go. Then this is the same questions from a slightly different point of view. This is actually the same thing, so you don't need to copy it down. It's exactly the same thing as I just said. Question: is cultural history only concerned with what people have in their head, their representations of the world? If it is, then some historians can say, well, yeah, representations are all very well, but then, if you go back to the time when there were slaves, a lot of the slaves considered that slavery was a normal thing. Because, of course, the ideas in their heads came from what they lived through. And they'd never seen a situation where there wasn't slaves. And so they're not individual things. I can give you an example from the First World War concerning French historians. For a long time, and even today to some extent, there is a big conflict in French historiography of the First World War between a group of historians rather more official support grouped together around the Historien de Péronne. And the centre of their research was culture de guerre. Qu'il y avait à l'époque, qui a été créée à l'époque, une culture de guerre. And so, fundamentally, and they also talked about, what's the word I'm looking for? Pas acceptation, c'est quelque chose comme ça. In any case, they put the emphasis on the idea that the people accepted the war. Qu'il ne faut pas pour eux, il ne faut pas considérer la guerre comme quelque chose qui a été imposé au peuple, mais quelque chose qui vient de la culture de guerre à laquelle participe le peuple. So, and of course, the people who disagreed with them said, oh, no. The people who disagreed with them put the emphasis on the elites and how the elites had, first of all, started the war and then tried to influence the attitudes in people's heads. So it was a question of how important is material reality. These are difficult questions. Another historian, more on the other side, said, pourquoi est-ce que les Français sont allés à la guerre en 14? Et sa réponse, c'est parce qu'il y avait la guerre. And this is not as stupid as it sounds, yeah? What he's saying is that ordinary people were used to somebody big and important deciding something, and then they had to do it. They closed the factory, you have to work in it. Okay, and so they were not expecting to decide about the war. They were expecting to have to follow whatever happened. And so the idea that, oh, look at all these people who agreed with the war might not be the full story, because they were not expecting anybody to ask their opinion. Yeah? So, and that's why he said, which is quite a very difficult question in a way, but quite interesting, pourquoi les gens sont allés à la guerre? Parce qu'il y avait la guerre. It's a more intelligent reaction than it sounds. It sounds a bit ridiculous to start off. Which is also the question of where does people's culture come from? It's all right to describe the culture of the 1960s, but where does it come from? And we get this as well. You look at the 1960s, rock and roll, the beginnings of music festivals, free jazz, all this new way of looking at leisure, teenagers and so on. And you can describe it, but you might also want to look, where did it come from? Where did it come from? Obviously, well, it seems obvious to me, smaller families, longer education, so the space for being an individual as a teenager is much bigger. If you're worrying about what you're going to eat, you're not going to be a very good teenager or rock and roller, really. And so finally then, again, I'm repeating myself, what do social and cultural historians have in common? An interest in history from below. Now, so the whole question is, quel priorité pour les historiens? And of course, from one point of view, every historian can choose their own priority. It's a free country. Now, why shouldn't you choose your own priority? On the other hand, of course, like I say, when you have 10 books on women in the First World War, and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds on men, then the question of each historian decides is perhaps not sufficient. Yeah? And this is why you sometimes have specific initiatives to try to encourage. I think in Britain at the moment it is Black History Month, which is to encourage people to write and study the history of black people. There is a woman's history press, that's a maison d'édition, there's a publisher, which only publishes books on women's histories. And the reason they exist is they say, look, there are not enough, so we're going to help a little bit. Yeah, yeah, it's like we would like not to be necessary. So there's all these questions coming up. And I do have one quotation from a great social historian, the great social historian of Britain, which is Eric Hobsbawm. Eric Hobsbawm wrote a series of books about the British history. The first one was called The Age of Capital, then The Age of Revolution, The Age of Reform, and the very last one is about the 20th century, and it's called The Age of Extremes. I thought it was a very good title, yeah, The Age of Extremes, the 20th century. It's true, the 20th century, you know, people live to be 80. People are, usually people's children do not die. Poor children have shoes. So it's very extreme good things. And then also, the Nazis and things like that were quite not very nice. So there's the extremes going in there. So this is what he says. He's reflecting about the arrival of cultural history. There's no question that our generation in the 50s and 60s, while they didn't entirely neglect culture, did not actually give it sufficient weight in our analyses. I think this must be so. So he's saying it's true that the cultural historians are making us look at questions we didn't look at. In the 50s and 60s, we were very interested in statistics about industry, about workers and so on. These changes... social history and then cultural history did not only affect the history of the First World War. All history, so the history of the Middle Ages, the history of the 19th century, they all went through a phase of social history and then a phase of cultural history. And finally, he also complains a little bit about the cultural turn, about the cultural history. The main trouble about the cultural turn is that an awful lot of it tends to move away, not merely from the social element of history, but also from the real history. For instance, the enormous range of studies of memory in the 70s and 80s, which are quite new, which didn't happen in our day. Well, memory is about today. Memory isn't about what happened. It's about what people later on think happened. So this is one of the things that he is not so happy. And final quotation then, Pascal Horry, qui essaie, donc il ne définit pas, je vous avais dit que ce n'est pas sûr qu'on définisse, l'histoire culturelle, méfiante a priori envers les interprétations unifiées qui mettent en scène un homme simplifié et rationnel, est l'infatigable avocat d'un être humain traversé et parfois animé par des contradictions internes. So what is he saying here? Well, the first thing is, c'est un peu codé, but when he says l'histoire culturelle se méfie des interprétations unifiées, do you know who he is criticizing? He's criticizing the Marxists. Tous les historiens qui lisent, ils comprennent that Marxism is an attempt at an interprétation unifiée. Marxism says that always, in every country, in every century, material production is the center of explanation. Yeah? So it is an interprétation unifiée. And so for Pascal Horry, that this is one of the things about cultural history, is to to reject that. And also his interpretation of Marxism is that it is about simple and rational men, whereas for him, cultural history is the kind of history that can talk about people being contradictory. Now, people being contradictory is very, very important indeed, especially in political history, because if you say, you know, does this group of people, English people or workers or whatever, do they believe this or do they believe this? Sometimes the question is both at the same time. That people have contradictory ideas in their head, and it is typical to have contradictory ideas in your head. It's not unusual or exceptional or a sign of madness. And if you're going to analyse social change, you need to take into account the fact that people can believe contradictory things at the same time. Yeah, and this was also the case during the war. Yeah, people could think that, you know, that the war was unfair, but that we had to win it. And so on. You know, people have contradictory ideas. That's what people normally do. Yeah, it's not just your mother, it's everybody's mother. Okay, that's enough for today. Thank you very much for listening. I'll talk to you again next week.